X-Rail Mark R. Perry, Charles K. Seifert, Elizabeth Scott Turner, Christopher Q. Adams, Amanda R. Lawrence, Appellant's Counsel. Samuel T. Towell, Deputy Attorney General, Richard S. Schweiker, Jr., Senior Assistant Attorney General, David B. Irvin, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Aaron E. Witt, Assistant Attorney General, Toby J. Heighton, Solicitor General, Michelle S. Callen, Deputy Solicitor General, Martine Ciccone, Deputy Solicitor General, Jessica M. Samuels, Assistant Solicitor General, Zachary Glubiak, John Marshall Fellow, Appellee's Counsel.
We welcome counsel to this virtual session of the Supreme Court of Virginia, and we particularly welcome those people who are connected to this hearing from the public. At this point in time, Mr. Seifert, you are appellant's counsel. I understand you are arguing. You may proceed.
Mr. Seifert, please the court. Good morning. My name is Chuck Seifert, and I represent the appellant, C Financial Solutions of Utah. I would like to preserve 4 minutes for a...
All right.
...action arises from loan agreements. NC Utah and its customers agreed that any disputes related to those loan agreements would be resolved in the form of arbitration. Pursuant to the federal arbitration, any claims for individual damages, whether brought behind by the individual or on the individual's behalf, fall squarely within the scope of the arbitration provision. In this action, the Attorney General seeks to circumvent the arbitration agreement by litigating in court the same individual damages claims that have been reserved for arbitration. Specifically, the Attorney General seeks to litigate in court claims for individual specific damages on behalf of, for the direct benefit of, the same individuals who contractually agreed to resolve those claims in the form of arbitration. Any damages obtained would flow directly to the individuals in amounts specific to each borrower. The effect and the end result of the Attorney General's claim is clear. The individual claims that have been reserved for arbitration would be litigated in court, and the arbitration agreement would be rendered meaningless. We contend that the Circuit Court erred in reaching its conclusion because its decision conflicts with the Federal Arbitration Act. Its decision expands the statutory authority afforded to the Attorney General under the Virginia Consumer Protection Act. And even if the court were to conclude that an implied right exists and that this Attorney General does in fact have statutory authority, allowing him to pursue that authority in this action would be preempted under the principle of conflict preemption. As the court knows from the briefing, the Circuit Court relied heavily on the Waffle House decision from the United States Supreme Court. And so I thought it made sense to start off on why this case is fundamentally different from Waffle House. And the short answer is, it is fundamentally different because the statutory structure at issue is fundamentally different. Waffle House is a case that involved Title VII, and Congress has made, it is a unique statute, to say the least. The EEOC has the sole authority to control a claim under Title VII, and that's as a result of the 1972 amendments and I believe the 1991 amendments. But the end result is Congress decided that the best public policy was to give the EEOC sole control, exclusive control, superior control of claim seeking damages or seeking individual damages, excuse me. And so it is the EEOC under that statutory structure that is the master of the complaint. Claims for individual damages are controlled and belong to the EEOC. They do not belong to the individual. And we know that from how the claims play out. Under that statutory structure, it is the EEOC who can decide, and only the EEOC who can decide, whether a claim goes forward. If the EEOC does, in fact, make that determination, then the individual's right to bring individual action is extinguished. There cannot be a situation where you have two actions pending both of which seeking individual restitution damages. If the EEOC decides to bring its action, the individual's right is foreclosed.
This is Justice Kelsey, counsel. May I interrupt you with a question? Prior to the congressional amendment to the Title VII to allow personal actions expressly in the statute, a personal right of action to be asserted by the EEOC, what was the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence on the defenses that would be available to the defendant when the individual is asserting it, but the agency, the federal agency, is asserting it on the individual's behalf? I'm particularly asking about Occidental and General Telephone, because that played a big role in the argument that went into the Waffle House case.
It did, and if I understand the question, Justice Kelsey, you would take the individual as you found it. The EEOC would take the individual as they found them. And so in that situation, any facts that would be specific to that individual would also be the way the EEOC would take that individual, if I understood the question.
So prior to the amendment that made express the right for the EEOC to make an ADA claim or any other type of Title VII claim on its own, in its own capacity, irrespective of the claimant, prior to that, the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted exactly the same series of statutes to say that, no, you do take the plaintiff as you find them, unless the statute says otherwise.
I think that's correct, Justice Kelsey, if I understand the question. And I think the backdrop of that is the amendments that Congress enacted was to, in some ways, both the 72 and 91 amendments, was to change the landscape. It was a public policy decision that the best way to address these harms was to make, I think as Justice Ginsburg said, make the EEOC the chief litigator, the exclusive litigator. And so it was a deliberate statutory structure that gave the EEOC the right to control the claim. And at issue here, as the court is aware, the fundamental difference is who controls the claim, who owns the claim at issue. It's not a matter of who signed the arbitration agreement. It's a matter of who owns the claim at issue. And in this action, we know, unlike Waffle House, that the claim at issue belongs to the individual. It does not belong to Waffle House. So, for example, picking up on my earlier point, it is the EEOC who controls the claim in that situation and in Waffle House's case. And so the court's concern there was that Mr. Baker, in that situation, had entered into an agreement that arguably contracted away the EEOC's right? And so it would be, if Justice Kelsey, if I offered to sell someone your car, it's not my car to sell. So it conceptually, that causes some problems. That's not the situation we have here. In this case, and a fundamental difference is that the claims at issue are, in fact, claims belonging to the individual. And there is no statutory authority under the VCPA that would allow the Attorney General to control, condition that claim. And so, for example, and the record is clear, whether we look at the prayer for relief or we look at the circuit court's opinion, it's clear that what the Commonwealth seeks to do here is to litigate individual damages claims on behalf of these individuals, the same individuals who contractually agreed to arbitrate those claims. And the damages then would flow back to the individual in specific amounts based on each individual's experience. That is litigating a Section 204 claim, pure and simple. And maybe a better example is, if we look at the briefing, and I think it's maybe footnote 12, of the opposition brief, the Attorney General acknowledges that in an individual restitution eligibility or awards that are sought here could be by a settlement or other private litigation. So the takeaway is that if an individual, say John Smith, commences an action, he litigates that action in arbitration, and Mr. Smith wins $25,000. The Attorney General acknowledges that that award of $25,000 would influence and have an effect on the claims they seek here. Well, if we back up, if it is a separate and independent right belonging to the Attorney General, belonging to the Commonwealth, that would not be the case. Only way a private settlement or other litigation affect rights at issue here are if the rights at issue here belong to the individual. And that is the fundamental difference. Is in Waffle House, the right at issue belonged to the EEOC. And so it's not, in this case, the right at issue belongs to the individual borrower. And by allowing the Commonwealth to litigate that same claim that belongs to the borrower in circuit court would effectively render the arbitration agreement meaningless. There would be no point to arbitrate.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey again. May I follow up with your understanding of preemption? Under your analysis, suppose the Virginia state statute says absolutely the AG can sue on behalf of consumers, and by the way, we say in our Virginia statute that no arbitration clause in the underlying debtor-lender contract will be recognized, period. Suppose it said that. Would the supremacy clause say, well, you know what? The Waffle House case was one federal statute, the ADA and the Title VII, versus another federal statute, the Federal Arbitration Act. This is the Federal Arbitration Act versus a state statute. Who cares what it is? Would that trigger preemption on its own anyway?
I think it could, but I like the question because it points out the fact that there's two important features of your question, maybe more, but two that I recognize. One is that Waffle House, both at the Fourth Circuit and at the Supreme Court level, the courts both struggled with the tension between Congress enacting two federal statutes, and the rule is, how do you reconcile those two, right? The rule of law and the rule from the Supreme Court is, when can you should. The situation you threw out, Justice Kelsey, is more similar to the class action waiver rule out of California, right? And so California had a rule that effectively said class action waivers and arbitration agreements are unenforceable. And it was found that that was, in fact, preempted. It's certainly conflict preemption, and it, depending on how it's drawn, could be larger than that. But I think in your example, the short answer is yes, preemption would exist. I think...
If that's right, if that logic works in terms of supremacy clause analysis, why isn't that the answer to this case? That, you know, you can't do this. The contest here is between a federal statute that's clear as a bell and some judicial interpretation of a state statute that may or may not say what the parties say it says. Why wouldn't the right answer be, well, you can say all you want to, but preemption still kicks in?
I would agree with that conclusion, the response being that there's multiple flaws with the circuit court's opinion, and we've tried to address all of them. And so if the question is whether we believe preemption applies here, the answer is absolutely yes. You can see that in the Third Circuit's opinion, old discount. You can see that the logic and how it's reached in the Robb opinion out of Delaware. So we would agree with the conclusion that even if you cured the statutory authority flaw, which is not cured and is an enormous flaw, you still have the preemption problem, and the claim still must fail.
And you're down to 2 minutes and 17 seconds. You may use your time however you would like.
I would like to reserve it for rebuttal, and thank you very much for the courtesy, Mr. Chief.
All right. Mr. Heitens?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Toby Heitens for the Commonwealth. So NetCredit repeatedly acknowledges that the Commonwealth cannot be compelled to arbitrate its own claims. And for that reason, this case comes down to two questions. First, is the Commonwealth entitled to seek restitution under the Virginia Consumer Protection Act? And if so, does the fact that a private party may have agreed to arbitrate her own claims for actual damages sufficient to take away the right of action that the Commonwealth would otherwise have? As the Circuit Court correctly held, the answer to the first question is yes, and the answer to the second question is no. The VCPA clearly distinguishes between private suits and government enforcement actions, and it specifically links a circuit court's authority to order restitution to a form of relief that only a governmental plaintiff can seek. Section 203 of the Act specifically authorizes the Attorney General to seek an injunction, quote, in the name of the Commonwealth. And Section 205 authorizes a circuit court that has granted such an injunction to enter a restitution order. Now, NetCredit is right that Section 205 does not use the precise word restitution, but that's because the statute gives the definition of restitution rather than using the term itself. Specifically, Section 205 acknowledges a court's authority to enter, quote, additional orders that may be necessary to restore any identifiable person, any money or property, which may have been acquired in violation of the Act. Your Honors, if that doesn't include the authority to order restitution, I'm not sure what Section 205 does, and NetCredit doesn't provide any account of what they think Section 205
does. Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. May I ask you also the same question? Suppose our statute in Virginia flat out said, look, here's clearly what we're doing, here's clearly what the AG has authority to do, and by the way, flat out writes it into the statute, we don't care if there's any arbitration or ADR defense whatsoever in the underlying contract, they're not applicable. Isn't that just an end run around preemption or an attempt to do something that could not be done directly?
So, Justice Kelsey, I would need to know a little bit about what that statute specifically said, because I think I'm going to agree with most of what you suggest, but not all of it. So,
well, let me make it clear then. Suppose the statute said, your statute, your situation, your case, but there's another clause, and the clause says arbitration agreements in the debtor-lender relationship are void with respect to the AG's assertion of the debtor's claims under the very same contract, by the way.
Well, Justice Kelsey,
could a state do that?
I'm not sure that a state could do that, Justice Kelsey, but I think the hypothetical statute you gave me is fundamentally different than the one we have here. And there's a very simple reason. These are not the debtor's claims. These are claims that belong to the Commonwealth as a matter of statute. And I think that is
a critical... But does the Commonwealth keep the money?
No, it does not, Justice Kelsey, but the same thing I suspect is true in EEOC versus Waffle House. I mean, I'm happy to talk about
The problem, though, this is very important. The problem that seems to be overlooked is Waffle House is Fed versus Fed. They're just trying to interpret their statutes. That's why it split the court. They're just looking at two different statutory schemes and trying to figure out how do you mesh them together. There's no preemption. There's no supremacy clause at all. Whereas here we have the Federal Arbitration Act that says flat out, this is the federal law. The Constitution says it governs all the states. And your reasoning appears to be nothing but a different way of saying we're not going to do that.
I don't agree, Justice Kelsey, and I think that's not what the Supreme Court of the United States said in Waffle House. In fact, I think that's the mode of analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court rejected in Waffle House. Because in Waffle House, the lower courts had endeavored to interpret the two statutes together, to reconcile the competing policies of the two statutes. And I think the Supreme Court of the United States said clear as day, that is the wrong analysis. The court specifically says it, I believe it's on page 293 of the United States reports, where they say this isn't a question about how to reconcile Title VII with the FAA. This is a fundamental question about the FAA. And the question under the FAA is whether a non-party can be bound by an arbitration agreement that it never signed. And that was the ratio decendi of Waffle House, and that is directly on point here. Because I want to go right to, I think, something that infuses NetCredit's entire argument in this case is this argument they make over and over and over again that these are rights that belong to the individual, and that's just not true under this statute. This right comes from Section 205, and Section 205 is not a right that belongs to the individual. And I have two ways of explaining why I think they're wrong about that. First, they're wrong conceptually, and second, they're wrong because the authority they cite doesn't say what they say it does. Conceptually speaking, I understand that compensatory damages and restitution can both take the form of money. But that does not mean they are the same remedy, and it does not mean that they are the same right of action. Damages, compensatory damages, and restitution are fundamentally different remedies at common law and today. One looks to the harm to the injured party, the plaintiff. That's what damages do. Restitution looks to the defendant, it looks to the wrongdoer, and it aims to deprive the wrongdoer of their ill-gotten gains. So even though they can both take the form of money, they're not the same remedy. And second,
but if that were the only policy, there would just be civil penalties, or there would be some sort of civil sanction that the government uses, which they do use a billion different ways in administrative law. But this is just suing on behalf of the private individual by another name.
I don't agree with that, Justice Kelsey, because that wasn't true in this case, and it's not true in Waffle House. I mean, I think this case is easier than Waffle House, because in Waffle House, the EEOC was not simply seeking an injunction. They weren't simply seeking restitution. The EEOC was seeking compensatory damages in the Waffle House litigation. I mean, that was identical to the claim that the individual could have pursued on his own behalf. And the court still said that didn't matter of the fundamental principle that you don't bind non-parties.
Help me out with this one last point, and then I'll leave it alone. Waffle House did not involve preemption, did not involve the Supremacy Clause, did not involve any constitutional question of the conflict between a federal statute and a state statute. Why isn't that a big deal point?
I completely agree with you, Justice Kelsey, that it doesn't, and neither does this case. Because in order for there to be a conflict, in order for preemption to come into play, the FAA has to be implicated in the first place. If the federal statute is not implicated in the first place, there is no preemption question. And that's the ground on which Waffle House was decided, and that's the ground on which I think you should decide this case. If I can turn, you know, the point that my friend on the other side repeatedly makes is he says, and they say it even more vehemently in their reply brief. They say twice in their reply brief, quote, "The right to restitution is a private remedial right belonging only to the individual." But just because the appellant says something over and over again doesn't make it true, and the authority that they cite for that proposition says absolutely nothing of the sort. So the only authority they cite for that claim, which they make twice in their reply brief, is this court's decision in First Virginia Bank versus Baker. And I went and read Baker, and I read it again right before this argument, and Baker says absolutely nothing of the sort. Baker does not even mention restitution anywhere in Baker. In fact, Baker actually helps us, not them, because one of the things that Baker turns on is the distinction between a cause of action on one hand and a right of action on the other. And what the court said in Baker is that the cause of action is the operative set of facts that give rise to the claim. But the right of action, according to the court, is the remedial right affording redress for a violation of the legal right. And the court specifically said in Baker that the same cause of action can give rise to more than one right of action. And that is precisely what we have here. The same lending transaction between NetCredit and its consumers gives a right of action to the individual consumer under 204, but it also gives rise to a right of action, not on behalf of the individuals, but in the name of the Commonwealth under 203 and 205. And that brings us straight into Waffle House, where it says, essentially, that's not the language the US Supreme Court used in Waffle House, but essentially what the US Supreme Court said in Waffle House is that when different parties have different rights of action, the fact that one party may have signed an arbitration agreement saying that their right of action would be litigated, if at all, in arbitration, does not bind the party that never signed that agreement in the first place.
Would it be fair to characterize your argument as saying the appellant is making a category error, and that is the premise of their argument?
Yes.
Okay.
The category error, articulate that a little more, Justice McCullough, the category error is the assertion, without any evidence that they make, that the Commonwealth is bringing the same right of action as the individuals would bring on their own behalf.
That is because at the end of the day, there's a pot of money that goes to somebody. Therefore, it must be that you're acting on behalf of the individual as opposed to in your sovereign capacity to vindicate statutory violations, and that one of the remedies available in your arsenal is restitution, but that is an adjunct of the Commonwealth acting in its sovereign capacity to vindicate statutory violations.
I completely agree with that, Justice McCullough. Yes.
OK. Okay, sorry, I interrupted you.
And let me address for a moment the repeated assertion by NetCredit that this renders their individual arbitration agreements meaningless, because I think that is also incorrect, both as a conceptual matter, but also as a practical one. No one, I don't want to be as clear as I can about this, to go back to something Justice Kelsey asked me about earlier, no one is arguing that consumer arbitration agreements are not enforceable with regard to FCPA claims. No one is contesting that if a consumer signed otherwise valid arbitration agreement, that agreement is enforceable in state and federal court and requires the consumer to pursue any remedies that they have under Section 204 in arbitration. And that doesn't just matter as a conceptual matter, it matters as a practical matter. And the Supreme Court of the United States talked about this in Waffle House as well. There are fundamental differences between private lawsuits and public enforcement actions. When the sovereign is trying to decide whether to bring a public enforcement action, it considers a great deal more questions than whether an individual violation occurred in an individual case. There are also inherently limitations on the government's ability to bring public enforcement actions. The vast majority of FCPA claims are going to be litigated, if at all, by the individual plaintiffs. And I think that just destroys, I think, NetCredit's argument that this deprives them of any benefit of their arbitration agreements. And so, Your Honors, at the end of the day, we think this case is quite straightforward. Principle number one, private parties may not contract away the sovereign's right to bring its own lawsuit seeking to vindicate policies that are set out in state law. Point two, because the VCPA gives the Commonwealth its own right of action in its own name, which includes the right to seek restitution, the judgment of the circuit court was correct and should be affirmed. Unless the court has any further questions, I yield back the remainder of my time.
All right. Mr. Seyfarth, you have rebuttal?
I do. Let me try to be brief and address these. First, the Commonwealth's claim is built on the idea that it has an independent statutory right. That idea is a fiction. We know that for several reasons, not the least of which is footnote 12 of their brief, which acknowledges that an individual's action, if an individual litigates his or her claim, that will affect the Commonwealth's claim. If the Commonwealth's claim was independent, as asserted, that would not be the case if it was a separate and distinct right. Also, I think it's important when we're talking about statutes to look at the statutes. And counsel points out there is no statement of restitution. We've cited in our brief 6.2, 1537, and 59.1, 466.7, both of which demonstrate that when the General Assembly means to give the authority of restitution, it states it very clearly knows how, and the fix here is a policy fix. The idea is not to have the judiciary enlarge the statutory powers under the VCPA. The idea would be for the Attorney General to go to the General Assembly and simply ask for the same language that he's received in those two statutes we highlighted. And finally, because there is no independent right, there is no independent statutory right belonging to the Commonwealth, because again, the Commonwealth acknowledges that the individual right will influence theirs. We're right back to Justice Kelsey's point, which at the end of the day is, even if you could establish statutory authority, which does not exist, and it's clear based on the face of the statute that it does not exist, even then you have a preemption problem. The Commonwealth on its best day is in an old discount and rot posture, both of which say that when the state creates a statute that is an obstacle to the fulfillment of the FAA, that statute must give way. And so at the end of the day, the circuit court's decision is in error as a matter of law, and we ask that this court respectfully reverse.
All right, thank you.